This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. I have the pleasure again today to read an essay by Dave Creer. Viroqua's own master naturalist, who works right here in town for Valley Stewardship Network. What a staff they have. He's one of a terrific group of talented, knowledgeable people. Check out what they do at valleystewardshipnetwork.org or stop in to see them on Main Street, just a little north of the Temple Theater. To learn more about this local, important organization that may be able to help you with issues you're concerned about on your land or even your backyard. Dave grew up on a small farm in Spring Green, just about an hour east of Viroqua. After earning a Bachelor of Science in Engineering from the University of Minnesota, he spent 35 years in the aerospace field, all while enjoying outdoor activities like camping, bicycling, birdwatching, fishing, and gardening. He earned his Minnesota Master Naturalist certification and participated in many citizen science projects. He also volunteers with the Friends of Vernon County Parks and Forests and has been coordinating bat surveys and chimney swift surveys to better understand these species locally. He works at Valley Stewardship Network as the Native Plantings Coordinator. He and his wife moved to Viroqua in 2016. In the past, I've read Dave's essays on creating prairie strips, on biodiversity, on water quality, dark sky, and how to light exterior parts of our buildings, his counting of bats and recording their sounds, his work with counting chimney swifts with a group of interested folks. If any nature-related projects sound like fun to be involved with, contact him at dave@valleystewardshipnetwork.org. All of my readings can be found archived at wdrt.org in the podcast section. This is a fun essay that Dave calls Name Calling. He spells his last name K-R-I-E-R. I'm surprised at the power of names. What we call something, a paint color, a plant, a building, or a bird, can influence how we think about it. I think I was in my 30s before I understood what the Empire State Building meant. What I mean is, as early as I can remember, maybe 4 or 5 years old, I knew what the Empire State Building was and could recognize it. It's famous for movies such as King Kong, to An Affair to Remember, to Independence Day. But it was when I was in my 30s that I saw the famous plaque in the lobby, a beautiful bas-relief design of the building superimposed over a map of the state of New York. It wasn't just the Empire State Building, where the words merged together to create the picture in my mind of the building. It was the building of the Empire State, and the Empire State is the slogan for the state of New York. The aha light bulb went off for me when I saw that, and now I know that when it was built, it was intended to mean this is the building of the Empire State. It's similar with many other things, too. The name is so common to us, we don't even think about it anymore. It just is in our brain. I remember one of those impactful English high school courses I had, where we learned the sources of words in our language, a practice called etymology. Learning that a word had an old French or Latin or Germanic background and what its base words meant was so empowering to me. Looking up the source of plant and animal common names is similar, and it sheds light on how a name can stick with something and misdirect us in how we think about it. In naming plants and animals, it was Carl Linnaeus in the mid-1700s who wanted to get away from common names that were different all over the world for the same thing and move to a two-part Latin naming convention so that whether you were in Europe, Asia, or the United States, a plant or bird could be exactly known. When it comes to plants, so many have common names that don't seem to help with knowing the true meaning of the plant. Sweet white or sweet yellow clover is one such plant. Its name, sweet, because when it's crushed during harvesting, it can smell sweet. At least that's what they say, though I don't quite get that when I smell it. But when you just hear the name, you think more of, oh, isn't that a great plant? It's sweet and it's clover. It must be great. In fact, it's a pretty mixed bag. It was brought to the United States as an agricultural crop in 1664. Apparently, even then, folks from Europe thought that there wasn't enough local forage for cattle or flowers for honeybees. On the plus side, it seeds easily, is the most drought-resistant legume, grows profusely, is a great producer of nectar for honeybees, and cattle love it. On the other hand, if it gets wet when it's harvested, it can be toxic to livestock. It produces a toxin which is an anticoagulant, blood thinner, and can hurt cattle. This feature of the plant is why it's grown specifically for rodenticides, too, and is the prime ingredient in rat poison. Probably most farmers would say it's a decent crop plant. Another downside, it is the bane of anybody trying to establish a prairie, like me, or other field of plants. It's terribly invasive, smothers any plants nearby, and is quite difficult to remove without herbicides. I've spent many hours trying to limit its impact on prairie plantings, so it's a bit of a two-edged sword. Then there's names we give to plants which do have a strong meaning, but it's often lost in the past. Arbovitae is one such name, which is French for tree of life. It's another name for eastern white cedar, which certainly seems more local or native than the French-based arborvita sounds. It got the French name because it turned out to be a treatment for scurvy in the 1800s. Scurvy is a very serious disease. At the time, no one knew the origin of this disease, but today we know that scurvy is caused by a lack of vitamin C that was missing in food supplied to soldiers and sailors of the time. Jacques Cartier was on an expedition to Canada in the early 1500s, and his men were suffering from scurvy. Almost 25% of them died from it. But when the Native Americans gave them a tea from the conifer, they recovered almost immediately because it contains vitamin C. He named the tree of life. Linnaeus's Latin system calls it Thuja occidentalis, but we call it arborvita still. Many plants have a location in their name, which is wrong. For example, the invasive Canada thistle is not from Canada. It came from the eastern Mediterranean region and was likely one of the first weeds that early settlers imported to North America. It also is very aggressive and difficult to remove. The plant was called Canada thistle because early New England residents blamed its emergence on French traders from Canada. However, historians believe it appeared in the United States and Canada at approximately the same time. A different local name, creeping thistle, is more apt. Thinking of birds, I feel like the robin gets short shrift. It's so common, it's easy to dismiss, and in fact, it is the most abundant land bird in North America. But what would happen if we used as its real name the red-breasted thrush? Other thrushes are valued more, like the wood thrush and the water thrush. Birders thrill at the sound and sight of them, while glumly discounting robins, noting, "I didn't see any birds today other than robins," sigh. The robin actually got its name from the European robin, because when Europeans came to North America, the bird's red breast reminded them of their robin. They're not closely related, but unfortunately the name stuck. And robins nearly have superpowers. They can find earthworms underground just by listening. I do have to acknowledge, though, that buying paint that is robin's egg blue is easier off the tongue than red-breasted thrush egg blue. Recently I was reading an excellent article in BWD, the newer version of Birdwatcher's Digest, about the ring-necked duck. I've always been confused by this name, as seeing a ring on the neck of this duck is very difficult and is definitely not the best way to identify the bird. A ring around the bill of the duck is very obvious, however. The article explains how it was named, again by a European, and one who had never seen a live version of the duck. A bird had flown off course during a migration and ended up in Europe. Then it was shot, stored for a few months, and somewhere in all that chaos, the bird lost a good part of its bill and the obvious ring on it. Only then did the person name it, obviously missing that it should be called the ring-billed duck, in which case we'd all remember it exactly when we saw the bird. I'm also reading an interesting book called The Birds That Audubon Missed by Ken Kaufman. He points out that in the 1700s, Europe ruled the scientific community and naming of plants and animals was done in Europe. The Royal Society was England's preeminent scientific organization, and they paid many people to go to America, send back notes and drawings of birds and plants, and as many bird specimens, dead, as possible. Then back in England, they would categorize and name them. Eventually, in the 1800s, naturalists like John James Audubon and Alexander Wilson would stay in America and create huge volumes of drawings, paintings, and notes on the birds of the Americas, yet they still got a lot wrong. A couple of classic examples of this misnaming are the Nashville warbler and Tennessee warbler, named because they were both observed in Tennessee, despite just passing through on migration for a few weeks of the year, and the dozens of birds named after people, many who maybe had never seen the birds but were relatives, friends, or sponsors of the folks in the Royal Society. There's dozens of those names. One they may have gotten right was the red redbird, now known as the cardinal, since it stays red all year. If we called them red redbirds, that would be a pretty good descriptive name. Other names may have worked once, but are increasingly incorrect. The common grackle may be one like that. I remember listening to a bird expert giving a presentation on bird conservation and what we can do to help birds. One of the pictures popped up and he said something like, "This is a common grackle, which isn't so common anymore." It turns out the grackle is in some trouble. Over the last 10 years, eBird calculates a 10% decline across the country, mostly in the Midwest. Around here, there's not so much change, but south of Chicago and in Ohio, where the majority of the common grackles are found, they're down over 20% in the last 10 years. The species is down a total of 60% over the last 40 years and is nearly threatened, considered a common species in steep decline. It makes me look at these birds when they're in my yard a little bit differently, thinking that they're fighting a battle for their species' survival, hardly common at all, as there are at least 17 birds in North America with common in their name, and of those, 25% are in steep decline. Also consider the naming of birds like the European starling, the European finch, and the house sparrow. All three birds are native to Europe, not North America. So why is our house sparrow then not called a European sparrow? When I think of the European starling, I think of the descriptor European as notifying me that it's non-native. Not only is it non-native, but it's invasive, as it's very aggressive, forming massive colonies that swarm and attack native birds. I wish I could enjoy them, but I don't, because of how bad they are for our local native birds. The house sparrow is viewed as a pest, also being very aggressive and bullying native birds, outcompeting them nearly everywhere. The house finch, however, doesn't have these negative connotations, even though it's not native here either. Another article from BWD magazine notes that they are originally from the west coast of the United States, where they were called the Hollywood finch. They were sold to the eastern part of our country as pets until there was a clampdown on the illegal movement of the birds out of their native territory. To prevent being caught with illegal birds, hundreds of shop owners released their birds, and they spread rapidly. Now, due to some disease problems, their populations have dropped, and they're not a particularly aggressive bird, so they seem to get along well and balance well with the native birds. so the term house isn't helpful or descriptive or differentiating in this case. Another poor name. Thoreau said, "For there is all the poetry in the world in a name." Maybe so for poets. I'm guessing I'm not a poet because I prefer more accurately descriptive words when trying to learn so many plants and animals and birds and insects. I'm sure I'm not alone, so keep learning more about the plants, birds, insects, paints, and buildings you see, and not relying just on their names to shape your opinion of them. And as your mother said, don't judge a book by its cover. And that's Dave Creer's essay called Name Calling. Next week, we'll have another essay by Dave Creer. This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. Thank you for listening.